Do we have the last word on vasectomy and prostate cancer?
Changing routine treatment after heart attack.
Do devices that help people monitor all kinds of things help them lose weight?
And should infants be exposed to certain foods early, or should they be withheld until later?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on September 23rd, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think I'd like to turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association, straight to this one where I said, wow, do these devices help people lose weight? I was absolutely astonished by the results of this study.
And I would voice that same thing, Elizabeth, because there's been this burgeoning use of these fitness devices. And the fitness devices are obviously designed to make us more fit, but we've not had any good studies looking at how effective they are. So this is a very well-done study with 471 adult participants studied over a two-year period. And these were individuals that were overweight, so they were all placed on a low-calorie diet. They were all prescribed certain physical activity, and they had group counseling sessions. And they did this for 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, onto that, they added routine things like there was a monthly phone call and weekly text messages. But half the individuals also received one of these fitness devices worn on the upper arm that monitored their activity and sent it automatically to a website. They could follow it. And at the end of 2 years, what they discovered was that the individuals that had the device lost less weight, not more weight, than what's called the standard intervention group. And when they looked at the total physical activity, there was no difference between the two groups. The addition of wearing wearable technology device to change their behavior didn't do a very good job of doing that.
I find this absolutely inexplicable. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on what you think happened here.
Well, Elizabeth, I think part of the issue is that the standard of the control group received much more intensive advice and intervention than we would normally receive. Most of us don't have coaches. We don't have 6 months of training and counseling sessions and group sessions. So I'm not sure that this really applies to what I'm going to call the general population. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. They're sure fashionable and they come in all kinds of great colors and you can wear them no matter what you're doing almost. I mean, even if you're swimming.
I think that the better comparison is to take individuals that don't have access to all these other interventions and have them wear one of these fitness devices versus people that decide on their own they're just going to try to modify their behavior. And I think that's the more relevant comparison.
Still an astonishing result. And I would also add that all of these kinds of things, these apps that are supposed to be helpful for people with chronic health conditions, I don't think we have the magic mix yet for determining how we're going to employ these so that they're most effective.
I agree, and that highlights the importance of doing studies, not only short-term studies, but also long-term studies.
Since we're in JAMA then, let's turn to this other ongoing issue, this idea of, wow, if we have a child who has a propensity to develop allergies, should we introduce them to foods that are potentially allergenic early in life or later?
This has undergone a change of thought. Back in 2000, the recommendation to parents was that they limit exposure of children to foods that are known to cause allergies, things like nuts and milk and eggs. But then in 2008, there was a revision saying, we're not so sure whether that's good advice or not. So what these authors did was they did a systematic review and a meta-analysis of the evidence that looked at the timing of allergenic foods and to their introduction during infancy and how that would influence the risk of allergies or autoimmune disease. And here's what they discovered. There was moderate certainty evidence from at least five trials of over 1,900 individuals that early introduction of eggs, that is at 4 to 6 months of age, was associated with a reduced egg allergy. It reduced it by about 44%. There was also moderate evidence from two trials of over 1,500 individuals that early peanut introduction at 4 to 11 months of age was associated with reduced peanut allergy. It reduced it by about 71%. Now, what they also noted is that there was high certainty that the timing of gluten introduction was not associated with celiac disease risk, and there was very low evidence that early fish introduction reduced allergic sensitization to fish. So early egg and peanut introduction to the infant diet lowers the risk of allergies of these two particular food products.
What this illustrates for me is that we know that breast milk is really great for infants. We know that. I think we could say that with 100% certainty. But this idea that, wow, bringing along these other things might reduce allergies is pretty compelling, especially because some of those reactions can be life-threatening.
Elizabeth, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting because during the time period from 2000 to about 2008, where we had asked parents to reduce exposure to these, the incidence of allergies to these food products increased 2 to 3-fold. This also ties in with previous things we've talked about, with reducing environmental exposures increases the risk of asthma as well. So this whole thing seems to be fitting together now.
So get your brand new infant a dog and feed him peanut butter.
I'm sorry, the dog or the infant?
I think probably both. I think it's sort of fun to watch a dog with peanut butter. Maybe that's a little mean. Let's move on then. Let's turn now to the Journal of Clinical Oncology. There's been this ongoing debate. Gosh, if men undergo vasectomy, does this increase their risk for prostate cancer? And in my mind, at least, this study seems to settle that issue.
And the reason why that has become an issue, or it's even on the radar screen, is there was a relatively small study. It was a prospective study published in 2014, an analysis of the health professionals follow-up study, where it appeared on the basis of 800 different individuals who had developed prostate cancer that there was a slight increase in the risk of incidence of prostate cancer and prostate cancer mortality in men that had vasectomy, about a 10 to 20% risk. Now, that was the first prospective study that had established it, but it obviously raises concerns because vasectomy is a highly effective method of birth control, and it's less expensive and causes fewer complications than tubal ligation, which is the equivalent surgical sterilization procedure in women. So we need to address this question. To do that, these investigators looked at prostate cancer mortality among over 360,000 men who participated in the cancer prevention study. Of those 360,000 men, over 7,400 died of prostate cancer. In that, there was a cohort of 66,000 men who they looked at not only the mortality, but also the incidence of prostate cancer to see whether there was any relationship to vasectomy. And what they discovered was that in men that had a vasectomy, there was not an associated increase in prostate cancer mortality, nor was there an increased risk of the incidence of prostate cancer. So these results from a much larger prospective study do not support the association of vasectomy with either prostate cancer incidence or prostate cancer mortality.
And I think this is really great news because, as you've already illustrated, it's a good deal easier for men to undergo vasectomy than it is for women to undergo tubal ligation. And this idea of population control is something that's important to all of us.
Yep. Elizabeth, I think you hit the nail on the head, and I really do think this settles the issue.
Finally, let's turn to your favorite topic. In the British Medical Journal, another look at beta blockers post-heart attack.
It wasn't too long ago we reported about a U.S. observational study that suggested that maybe long-term use of beta blockers after a heart attack wasn't useful. And the reason why I bring this up is not only because I'm a cardiologist, but because literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of individuals are put on a beta blocker after they've had a heart attack and then continued on it lifelong. We know there are certain lifelong medications that are helpful in people that have had heart attacks, things like aspirin, for example, or statins. But the issue of beta blockers is really unsettled because early studies that suggested their long-term benefit were conducted decades ago before we were using what's called reperfusion therapy, that is clot-busting medications, or even doing balloon angioplasty or stenting in people with heart attacks. So this study conducted in over 2,600 consecutive patients who had an acute myocardial infarction in France looked at the mortality at 30 days, 1 year, and 5 years tied to the ongoing use of beta blockers. And here's what they discovered, that within 48 hours of your heart attack, if you took a beta blocker, it decreased your mortality by about 54%. That's pretty good. Now, continuing beta blocker after hospital discharge to a year slightly decreased mortality by about 23%, but it wasn't statistically significant. But continuing longer than a year, there was really no benefit at all. So this questions the utility of using beta blockers after a year of the heart attack.
And I'm guessing here that for your patients, you will place them on a beta blocker and continue for a year?
I think that should be the routine practice. Now, by the way, the caveat is, let me back up. We know that if people have left ventricular dysfunction, that is that they have heart failure or depressed heart function after their heart attack, they should be on a beta blocker lifelong. So we're talking only about those people that have had a heart attack and have preserved heart function. I don't think there's any benefit of putting them on a beta blocker for longer than a year.
Okay, so then also let's just reiterate once again, what are the contraindications for beta blocker therapy?
there are actually very few contraindications. People that have advanced lung disease, that is, have advanced emphysema, people that have a really slow heart rate or low blood pressure, or people that have specific EKG abnormalities. But I'd say that 95% of individuals who've had a heart attack are candidates for beta blocker therapy.
What about the presence of comorbidities?
Really no other comorbidities. We used to think that you shouldn't receive it if you're diabetic, but that's not true. We used to think you shouldn't receive it if you had peripheral vascular disease, but that's not true either. So comorbidities play a little role in these individuals. I think the two studies, one in America and France, provide great insight into how we should be prescribing these medications.
On that note then, I think I'm going to talk about the weight loss and the devices in the Journal of the American Medical Association this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.